The topic tonight is Canada's invisible generation of Native children. I suppose that in general, the most downtrodden, the most marginalized people in our society are the invisible members of our society. When we go through walk down the streets of Toronto or Ottawa, most people don't even see the homeless who are begging on the street corners or who are lying on the vents. Most people don't pay attention to those who single mothers without enough money to support their children, poverty in our midst. So they are invisible in plain sight as well. But I think that the children, the Native children of the North, they are invisible, and it is really a tragic situation. The whole concept of invisibility, I suppose, struck me when I read for the first time the novel by the great African-American novelist, literary critic and scholar, Ralph Ellison. In 1952, he wrote a book in which his protagonist is an African-American who is invisible at his college in the American South. And when he goes to New York, he's invisible on the streets, not because people can't see him, but the mainstream society looks right through him, because in those days, American society looked right through black people. Black people were not part of the power structure, and they were discriminated against, as we all know. But he wrote this book, and then other writers, other black American writers, like James Baldwin, Langston Hughes, Richard Wright, came forward and wrote about the condition of black Americans. And they helped in an intellectual and also in a visceral, emotional way, in preparing the way for the civil rights movement, which came later in the late 50s and the early 60s. I guess the question is, to what extent do books and literature and intellectual preparation contribute to changes in society, changes which bring about more justice for large segments of society? You could ask the question, what brought about the American Civil Rights Movement? Was it the authors who wrote and prepared the ground? Was it the protest movements in the streets? Was it the change in American society, a more educated society? All of those things played their part. But I tend to think that the intellectuals and the writers played a major part in making black Americans visible in the United States. We are a long way in Canada and in other countries of the world where there are indigenous populations in having those populations made visible. I served in Australia. I was High Commissioner there about 10 years ago or so. And I met with Aborigine women who had gone through something similar to the residential school situation in Canada. In Australia, up till the 70s, any child born of an Aborigine mother and a white father was removed from the mother, and they never saw the mother again. And they were put in institutions, and they were trained, given basic education, and trained to be servants and workers for the dominant white society. And the tragedy of it all is that the Australians who did that thought they were good people, and they were doing this for good purposes. Of course, there was always this strain in their society and in Canadian society as well toward Aborigine people. There's always a slight doubt that maybe the Aborigine people and the First Nations people are not fully human. Because if they were fully human, they'd be living in big cities and they'd be reading books and they would be not Neolithic as they were. So there was always this suspicion. But it was a tragedy of good people doing bad things. Now, the native people, in general, are invisible in plain sight. They're the poorest component of society. They're the subject to the greatest discrimination. The Ipsos polls show consistently that Aboriginal Canadians are on the top of the list of the people most discriminated in the country, followed by Arab Muslims, followed by Black Canadians. But the Native Canadians are consistently the ones at the most discriminated against in the country. Their other statistics are just terrible as well. 20% of all prisoners in federal jails are Native. 600 women have, as they say in an euphemistic way, have disappeared. In fact, murdered. Some of them chopped up and fed to pigs in British Columbia. And as Annie was mentioning, I'm sure she was referring to the two young girls in Maniwaki who have been missing for so long and must be of tremendous concern, that white men feel that they can do whatever they want with Native women because they're just Indians. And maybe they're not fully human. Native people have the lowest levels of literacy in the country. If you're a Native student, it will take 28 years, according to the Auditor General, for Native students to graduate at the same rate as non-Native students, except that that is growing more and more broader, taking more and more time. Large numbers of communities, up to 50% in the remote parts of Ontario, do not have potable drinking water. 50% of the homes on reserves are contaminated with mold. Tuberculosis is making a comeback. Diabetes is at least three times the rate as the rest of the population. And I say that they're invisible because every day almost a major story appears in the media about Native living conditions and nothing is done about it. The Canadian Auditor General has sent more than two dozen reports to the House of Commons calling for action on a whole range of issues, but these reports have been ignored. There is a situation which exists in this country which is similar in a way to what happened in the American South up till the Civil Rights Movement took place, and that is we have an education on reserves which is separate, in theory equal, but is unequal. You recall that that was one of the motivating factors behind the Civil Rights Movement, was to improve the education of Black Americans, prevent this unequal system. But in Canada, that exists to this day. And if you are a Native child on a reserve in Canada, you will receive approximately 80% of what a white child will receive off-reserve. And so the governments will say, well, it's a federal provincial problem. The feds are in difficult budgetary things, and so they can't give as much to native kids as the provinces give to white kids for their education. But that is just basically wrong. That is contrary to everything that we say we stand for around the world. And I don't understand why there is not a rising up in the population, like happened in the American South, and say, we can't take this anymore. There is one girl called Shannon who has launched a campaign across the country to try and deal with that. But unfortunately, she was killed in a car accident about a year ago. But the children, a lot of young people in the country have taken up her cause, and it is probably the largest youth-run movement in Canada today. But other than that, the situation of this inequality in education for Native children is shrugged off by our population. And this pains me the most, is that there is no outrage in Canada over the fact that an epidemic of suicide among the young people has been going on in Native communities throughout the North for year after year after year. But every 10 days in Northern Ontario, in the land of the Anishinaabe-Aski Nation, which is 49 communities in the North, a Native child kills himself or herself. When I became Lieutenant Governor in 2002, I adopted three social justice causes. One was mental health, the other one was anti-racism, and the other one was the cause of Native youth. And my first visit to the North, and you have to go in by air into these communities or winter road because there are no regular roads in there. I went to a community called Kaseshawan. Maybe some of you have heard of it because I think some of their people came down here during a big flood and stayed in Ottawa for a while. But as my plane was landing, there was a plane waiting to take off, and there was a crowd of people. And after the plane landed and I got out, and I asked the chief what was going on, and he said that a 12 or 13-year-old girl had killed herself. And I said, why? And he just said, well, she had no hope, as if explained everything. Then I got a call from the Grand Chief not too long afterwards to say that three kids in Wanaman Lake First Nation had killed themselves. One of them, a girl, hanged herself in a tree as the kids were coming to school in the morning. And I went up. The Grand Chief asked me to go up, and I spoke to the families. I spoke to the remnants of their combined grade 7 and 8 class, and I could see from they were wearing hoodies, and they wouldn't look up, and they were in a state of terminal depression, I could see. And it wouldn't be long before others, I thought, would take their lives. And that was the same. I got the same answer. Everyone said they had no hope. And then it went on from community after community, the same thing. I went to one community which wasn't a fly-in, Mishkogogamang First Nation, and a community of about 1,500 people. And the chief told me that in the past 10 years, 300 people had died violent deaths in that community. The worst parts being the children. But everybody, they were in a state of self-hatred. The kids especially. When I drove through the community, you saw houses. There had been some new houses had been built. The kids had gone in and trashed it and threw all the furniture out in the street. They went and burnt the school down. They started killing themselves in large numbers. And so when you went through the community, you saw all these graveyards with mounds of coffin-sized mounds throughout them with crosses, because it was a Catholic community, with children's dolls and baseball caps and fishing equipment. And the chief said, what am I going to do here? And that goes on and on to this day. How did we get to this terrible circumstance? Well, just a very quick capsule summary of native white relations. When the Europeans came to what is now Canada, let's say starting with the French in about 1600, they needed the native people for furs, and also, very important, they needed them as objects of to save their souls. So they didn't want to kill them off, and they formed alliances with them. Then as the years went by, the native people became allied with the French and then with the British and helping them fight their wars. And so they were important as trading partners, as places for conversion to Christianity, and as absolutely necessary in their wars against each other until the War of 1812. And in the War of 1812 in Canada, if it hadn't been for the arrival of a couple of thousand Shawnee warriors from the Ohio Valley who came up thinking that if they allied themselves with the British, they could stop the American expansion into the Ohio Valley and westward, and the Iroquois from Six Nations who intervened in the Battle of Quinston Heights and saved the day after the death of Brock, and the people from the Georgian Bay and Lake Simcoe, including one of my direct ancestors who held off the Americans until the British could escape to fight another day. Upper Canada would have been lost to the Americans, and we'd all be, instead of the Union Jack, we would have the Stars and Stripes here. And for Native people, there wouldn't be anybody here at all, because the Americans expelled all their Native people, with the exception of some Iroquoian tribes, to the West in the 1830s. And so we had a very good relationship until the War of 1812. But after that, in Canada, the Natives were just a pain in the neck and an obstacle to settlement. And the government moved toward establishing treaties, which they had no intention of observing. And then, since they were good people, they decided that what the best thing for the native people would be to take their children away from them and turn them into brown-skinned Euro-Canadians. And so they began in the latter part of the 19th century with the residential school system. And for the next 100 years, 150,000 Native children attended residential schools. And in the 1920s, they brought in a law in which said if the parents didn't give the children up voluntarily, they would be taken by the RCMP to the schools. And so it was a forced assimilation. Can you imagine what it would have been like in those communities, let's say Mishkagogamang, where they have such terrible problems today? The children were all gone at the age of six. So there would be childless communities. And the parents, they must have felt terrible. And the children were then put into the hands of teachers and priests and there was Catholic, there was United, Methodist, and then United, Presbyterian. And there was no accountability. And so they could do with the kids what they wanted. And they did. And it was an era in Canada when they used corporal punishment for white kids, but up there it was corporal punishment with a vengeance, and also rape and anything they wanted to do, because there was no accountability. And no one cared, because they were invisible kids to society. And they were just Indians. And so what would happen was the children would come home for the summers, But at the age of 16, they would return, not knowing how to raise their own families, because they had been raised in institutions like they were orphans or as if they were prisoners. Then they would have children. Then when they were six, they'd be taken away. And then it was compounded, generation after generation, until the family structures collapsed in many parts of the country. So 1972 was the last residential school in Ontario. And that was accompanied by the Ontario government coming in and taking responsibility for child welfare. And so they came in and they saw that the children were being neglected because all of this generations of lack of parenting skills, and they removed thousands of children. And they adopted them out across North America. Some cases it worked out well, other cases it didn't. But the communities were shattered. Then up in the north you had the winter roads came in, and the people were exposed to modernity away from their traditional lifestyle. And what they saw with modernity was racism. Kids, when they came out, were looked down upon. And they weren't allowed in those early years to... they always found excuses for them not to be accommodated in motels. And even today, I was visiting fellow at Laurentian University and speaking to the Native University students there. They say that when they come off the reserve and they phone to rent an apartment is available till they appear, and then it's suddenly no longer available. And so they regard themselves as being looked down upon by society. And with all these years at the residential schools, they were told that they were savages, that they're ancestors, because they had not heard the word of the Lord, were burning in hell, and that it developed a tremendous sense of insecurity among these children. And so that is why I believe that starting about 10 years after the closure of the last residential school in the province, all of a sudden the children began to kill themselves. In the south, you had the phenomenon among the Iroquois, Mohawks, and others that when problems got really tough, they take to the streets, they demonstrate, they fight. But in the north, when these things happen, they kill themselves. They give up and kill themselves. And so every year since, for now 30 years, this has been going on. The Grand Chief called me 2 weeks ago to say that three kids had recently killed themselves at Pecanchicum. I think that brought to 18 the number in one community alone that had died in the past 5 or 6 years. And the situation is not improving at all. And I was just absolutely devastated because I had been through my own mental health problems. When I was High Commissioner to South Africa, I was beaten up. I nearly died in a botched hotel room robbery. Maybe it wasn't botched. He took everything he wanted. But I nearly died because he broke my nose. And then when he tied me up and stuffed a gag in my mouth, I began to suffocate to death. And I managed to spit it out and then beg for my life. And it was a terrible... I was already going through a bad depression anyway, and so I became very suicidal. And I managed to pull myself out of that because I was one of those 1 in 3 people, so I'm told, who respond very well to anti-serotonin blockers, to medication. And so I live a very normal life as long as I stay on my pills. But I could just understand believe what these kids were going through, that they felt so bad that they had to die. And I therefore decided that I would try and do what I could to help them when I was lieutenant governor. And I remember growing up in the village of Port Carling. My mother was married when she was 14. I'm very happy she's still alive, from the Chippewa Zarama First Nation, and she married a young white man who was about 18. He was an unskilled laborer. He had four children. They were not accepted in either the white society, and they weren't allowed to live on the reserve because in those days, Native women, if they married a white man, could not live on a reserve, and their children couldn't get status. All that changed in 1985, and we all got our status. We're all brought into the reserve. But in those days, we didn't belong to either world. And we lived up by the village dump at the beginning. But it wasn't something terrible. I mean, I thought it was wonderful, actually, to live near a dump. Because in Muskoka, you had all these rich tourists. And today, people would put the type of thing they threw out, they'd put it out and sell it in garage sales. But there, they just threw it in the back of trucks. And it was before the time of trucks where they crushed the garbage, so garbage was nice and pristine. And so my brother and I would just chase those dump trucks up the road, and we had our pick of wonderful comic books and toys, and then we were surrounded by our own private zoo. There were raccoons, skunks, rats, mice. And then we had an aviary. We had seagulls, crows circling overhead. Now, to this day, I can't smell burning cardboard without getting a little nostalgic. And I learned to read from the comic books at that village dump. And when we went on to, my mother was tired of moving from town to town, and so she, the baby bonus had come in, and she went to a lady who owned an old abandoned shack in the village. People had been trying to buy it for years, but when she was a black Canadian, and she had been discriminated in the village, so she wouldn't sell. But when my mother appeared as a poor Indian lady and said, "I will give you my baby bonus until the $250 for this property is paid off," it was done. So we lived in this old shack, one room downstairs, two rooms upstairs, no electricity for a year or two, outdoor toilet. It was a big step up. And I had learned to read. I went to school. We faced the discrimination of that period. But I knew how to read. And knowing how to read, I had a head start on all those other kids who didn't have the advantage of living up by a dump. And so I was the privileged one. And I went to the library. And my dad always said, he always expected that we would follow his footsteps and be ditch diggers. And his main advice was, no matter how much you drink, my boy, you've got to go to work in the morning. That was about the extent of his philosophy of life, which wasn't bad. But I didn't want to be a ditch digger. And I saw in those books that there was such a world out there that was waiting if you had an education. And so the next big break came, and this is something which I would advise everybody to do. I worked on the estate of the chairman of the board of Pittsburgh Paint and Plate Glass. My Indian grandfather had been a guide for the founder of Pittsburgh Paint and Plate Glass. My dad had worked on the estate as well. Then I worked on the estate. So it was like the American South. We were part of the plantation in Muskoka. But he was a wonderful old gentleman. And one day when I was in grade 12, he called me up and said, he understood I was still in school, and he asked me if I would like to carry on and do my grade 13 and go on to university, and I said, yeah, of course. And so gave me a scholarship from Pittsburgh Paint, and I went to London, Ontario, did my grade 13, and I went to the University of Western Ontario, graduated in honors history, and then join the Foreign Service. So my advice to everybody is find a rich American at the important key point of your life, and you'll do very well. But what I learned was, the lesson I took from that was, first of all, you've got to get along with people, and secondly, the importance of books for opening up your imagination. Because no matter how poor you are, if you can travel with a book, and so therefore, that was my approach to trying to help the kids in the north. And so, some of you may remember, I launched huge book drives in Ontario. I sat next to the commissioner of the OPP at a dinner once, and I said, "Can you help?" And she thought I meant just a little bit of help, but she said yes. And for next thing you know, every OPP station in the province of Ontario was collecting books, and they had to move the cruisers outside because they filled up. We collected in two book drives over 2 million books. We had to use the Downsview armories to accommodate mountains of books. They came in tractor trailer loads. And then I had no budget. I had not done a 5-year plan. I just said we'll collect as many as we can and sort them and find some way of getting up there. But retired teachers came up, retired librarians, police auxiliaries, military, scouts, they all showed up. And we sorted those down to 1.5 million books. Then the military came in and gave a bit of help. They parachuted books into a few communities. I remember going up to Fort Severn. Military were coming with a big cargo of books which would be parachuted into the community. And the entire community, we went on the fort on the riverbank. It was about minus 30, minus 35. And we could hear the roar of this big, see the big Hercules aircraft coming up the river, delivering knowledge to the children. Then the back of it opened. Then the parachutes came out. And the books plummeted straight to the ground because the parachutes didn't open. Meanwhile, I had global television, CBC National News, and everybody. And they said, "Is that supposed to happen?" I said, "Sure." So we all went out and we picked books out of the snow. And they had a library, but mainly an Aboriginal airline, Wasaya Airlines. They flew them in. They gave about $500,000 worth of free service to get the books into the community. And we established libraries throughout Ontario, also throughout Nunavut. Also, I sent 4 tractor trailer loads to the Cree of Northern Quebec. And then I sent, because the Premier of Grenada asked me for some help, I gave him about 18,000 books after the hurricane down there. And what didn't go there, the books that we had culled were taken off to Africa. And so it was a very, very wonderful thing. And then I moved to raise money to establish summer reading camps for kids. And I raised about $7 million. And the program went on. This summer, my money finally ran out, and we did 40 reading camps in Northern Ontario. Hopefully, the sponsors will carry on, and the camps will continue. We send up 100 university students every year into the communities. The communities put in another 200. I established Club AMIC, which Reverend Bailey mentioned. I raised $1.5 million for that. And every 3 months, the children receive a brand new quality book to keep in every fly-in community of the province, in the areas where the children are the most disadvantaged, so that they can establish their own libraries. I established a literary prizes for 500 Aboriginal students across the province, First Nation, Métis, and Inuit. Submit short stories and poems, and the top 6 get $3,000 prizes, and then we take them down to see the big powwow in Toronto, and it's very popular. I did a variety of other things as well. I went to the Players Association and the Toronto Maple Leafs and got them to provide brand new sport hockey equipment to 20 of the communities. The problem is that one individual cannot do what governments can do, because my term ended, my money is running out, and the conditions carry on. The basic issue is that the native children receive 20% less per capita than white kids, and therefore the schools have no money for books, special education teachers, and the teachers, many of them come in and they leave right away because they can't take the cultural shock. And so what I then did was I remembered my days back around in Port Carling and how important books were to me, and moved it. If I couldn't provide them books, I would write books for them. And so I wrote As Long as the River Flows, which is the first book which describes the life of someone who has gone through the residential school system. I spoke to dozens and dozens and dozens of survivors of residential schools, and my main character is an amalgam of three women who I spoke to about her life, how she was taken away at the age of 6 from a little reserve in the north, flown to a residential school on James Bay, where she was raped by the priest repeatedly over the years. And then when she left, she went into a deep depression and then started drinking, where she had children. Children's Aid took away one of the children. And then she went to Toronto to look for the child and discovered that she could have as good a life in Toronto as a native person as she would have back on the reserve, but then was forced to return. And then the suicide epidemic among the kids was going on, and they finally decided that they would have a healing circle to try and have a cathartic way of dealing with all this grief that had gone on. And I went to three conferences organized by Native people, for Native people in Northern Ontario, to try and deal with suicide. And in every case, you would have a healing circle. And they would have a talking stick. And the survivors of suicides would sit in a circle. And as long as the person held the stick, they could not be interrupted. And even if the person said nothing and just cried, you could never ask for the stick. And I put in this book, I have the amalgam of a number of the stories or of the accounts of the women who saw, or parents who saw their children die. Perhaps I could read you one of those accounts. Not too easy to hear. The mother of Rebecca, the first of the three children to die, embraced the talking stick and said nothing as tears rolled down her cheeks. She twisted her hands and shifted her weight from one side of her seat to the other, and she did not break her silence. Finally, in a small, lisping voice, she started to speak, holding her hand in front of her mouth. I feel so bad. She was so young, our only child. Who would have thought it? I've not spoken of my pain before. It was too hard. The mother sobbed openly, abject and animal-like in her misery, and leaned her head on her husband's shoulder. He, too, began to cry and held her tightly. I was the one who found her, she said, straightening up and no longer attempting to hide the gape in her mouth. I'd been drinking, and my husband and I were fighting, Don't even remember what it was about. He'd slugged me in the mouth, knocking out most of my front teeth and opening up my lip. And he hit me again, giving me a black eye. I went out and got a piece of firewood and gave him a taste of his own medicine. I guess we were both pretty drunk. Rebecca came in, yelling for us to stop. She was crying like crazy and saying she couldn't live no more like that. She decided to kill herself, she said. It was a cry for help, but I didn't believe her. She'd said the same thing before, but had never done nothing. She'd always been a handful, and I thought she was just acting up. I laughed at her and told her how easy she had it compared to the old days when we lived on the land, when it was a life and death struggle to survive. I told her the government gave us everything. The government would give her everything, so what was her problem? I turned her away. She was hanging by a wire from a clothes hook in the closet. I blame myself, and I feel bad. I should have listened to her and told her that I loved her. A long silence followed, disturbed only by quiet weeping from someone in the audience, and the woman began again. When I look back, I realize I was always too impatient. She could never satisfy me. I wasn't there to fix dinner for her. I never encouraged her to do good in school. I was always shouting at her, just like the nuns used to do to me at residential school. Her husband held his head in his hands and loud, convulsive sobs racked his body. "It gets worse," the woman said, reaching over and trying to wipe away the tears of her husband with her hand. "When she was just a little girl, she told me her grandfather was touching her in her private parts and doing things to her. I freaked out because that's what the priest used to do to me, only worse. But to my shame, I blamed her for tempting her grandfather. I slapped her just as I'd been slapped by the nuns when I asked them to tell the priest to leave me alone. She must have felt bad, just like I felt when that happened to me. I know it went on for years, and I never did nothing to stop it. I'm so ashamed." Stories like that is what we would hear. Everybody would be crying. We'd be there for 2, 3, 4 hours. But the wonderful thing about it was that at the end, everybody would be smiling because they had a cathartic experience. They realized that they had been bad parents. But they also realized that life had to go on, and by letting it hang out in public like that, they had been able to come to some understanding, at least on a deep emotional level, of what was going on. And so I wrote this book. It is not of the quality of a Ralph Ellison or Langston Hughes or Toni Morrison or Nadim Gordimer or of J.M. Coetzee. But I think that it's very important that the story of, or the condition of, Native children are understood in the population as a whole. We have to make a start to making Native children visible. We have to correct this anomaly in our society in which a whole segment of the children are not provided the same rights as white children. That is why I wrote this. And I've just finished another book on a slightly different theme, which I hope will go out and contribute to an understanding of what really goes on in the Native community. Thank you very much.